The Freeman Report and James Freeman on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
As Americans debate who will become the next president of the United States, the impact of this year's election on world events cannot be underestimated. In the Middle East, the Biden administration is wary of dictating terms on Israel's handling of its campaign against Hamas that has resulted in so much carnage. For fear of upsetting powerful Israeli Zionist lobbies in America. And this despite significant rumblings within the Democratic base surrounding the number of civilians being killed in the Middle East. On Iran, we're told that the Biden administration will not enforce sanctions on Iran's oil exports because of the impact it will have on oil prices, and in turn, the prices that Americans pay at the pump, for fear that it will upset voters. This is not a suggestion that Biden should punish Iran. Personally, I think that would be unwise, given that the Iranian attack was in retaliation for Israel's strike on its consulate in Syria. The issue I raise is how this year's US presidential election presents a clear and present danger to the world, given the weakness of Joe Biden, the current President of the United States. It is clear that the world needs right now, what the world needs is a US president that projects power, takes decisions, and sets a clear pathway on foreign policy. But instead, we've got a president who prefers to sit idly by, leaving a dangerous vacuum in his wake. What we've got at the moment is Joe Biden being a backseat driver who is trying to drive world affairs without putting his hands on the wheel, which is a dangerous way to conduct foreign policy, given the different players and complicated politics of the Middle East. At some point, things will escalate if nobody is setting a clear path, precisely because nobody has got a firm grip on the wheel. Because sometimes doing something is the best option, as to do something and set a clear path projects power, which deters others from overstepping the mark. Biden's response to the Iranian attack was to ask the Israeli government to take the failure of the attack to cause significant damage as a win. He could have warned Israel not to escalate tensions further, but instead he chose to request Israel see the situation in a certain light. And based upon leaks coming from Israel today, it is clear that his request has carried no weight whatsoever, as news outlets in Israel are reporting that Netanyahu has ordered the Israeli Defense Force to compile a list of targets for retaliatory strikes against Iran. Biden's requests for Israel to minimize civilian casualties have also fallen on deaf ears over the past couple of months, as the bombing on civilians has continued. They even continued while Iranian drones attacked Israel at the weekend. Now, a statement by Oxfam claims Israel's military is killing Palestinians at an average rate of 250 people a day, which massively exceeds the daily death toll of any other major conflict in recent years. This weakness inherent in Biden's ability to command foreign policy, in my opinion, is extremely worrying. We've got 9 months until the inauguration of the next president of the United States in January 2025, which makes the next 9 months one of the most dangerous periods certainly in my living memory, but I think in living memory. So to discuss Biden's weakness on foreign policy and the danger this presents to the whole world, I'm going to be joined by TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, in a moment. And then in the second hour of the show, I'll be joined by TNT host Johnny Vedmore, who's going to talk about Iran in the context of the current conflict. Coming up this hour, I'll also be discussing UK immigration with independent political consultant Charlie Downs. I'll be asking Charlie what he thinks the government needs to do to solve the UK's current immigration policy, on problems. I think he's got a clear idea on what the government needs to do, but I'll be asking him that question and we'll be talking about it all in a moment. But before we go over to today's breaking news with Gemma Cooper, I'd like to see all of your favourite, if you'd like to see all of your favourite freedom fighters on one stage across one weekend. If the answer to that question is yes, then listen up. The Weekend Truth Festival will feature speakers such as Katie Hopkins, Kate Shimarani, Dolores Cahill, Matt Letizier, Mark Atwood, David Clues, Allegedly Dave, Sovereign Pete, and many others. All of this across one weekend on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of May in Workington near the Lake District in the UK. All you need to do is bring a tent, a sleeping bag, and some good vibes as food stalls, workshops, bushcraft, and amenities will all be provided on site. For more information and to find out how to reserve your place at the festival, please visit weekendtruthfestival.co.uk. That's weekendtruthfestival.co.uk. But don't hang around. I think when I spoke to Kevin, who's organising the festival a couple of weeks ago, there were only around 150 tickets available then. So I've got no idea how many are available now. So if you do want to go to that, please don't hang around. Get over to weekendtruthfestival.co.uk straight away to reserve your tickets. To get in touch with me about any of the topics on the show or to suggest guests, as listeners frequently do, then email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And if you don't follow me on TNT, if you don't follow me or TNT on social media yet, on Getter, Gab, X, Fakebook, whatever your favorite platform, then get yourself over there now and give us a follow and a shout out and help us spread the word about TNT. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk TNT.
Talk that matters.
For once, we just need to do what's best for this damn country and not what's best for the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, over to our UK news correspondent, Gemma Cooper. How are you doing, Gemma?
Yeah, not too bad. And some interesting headlines have broken in the last hour. One of them, very interesting, is that police in Brussels were tasked with trying to shut down an event called National Conservatism. Nigel Farage, the honorary president of the Reform Party here in the UK, was on the stage as the police arrived, and Suella Braverman was due to take the stage after. The police haven't shut it down. They say they were on the request there of the Brussels mayor, who said that the far right, that's what they're dubbing this conference, had no place in Brussels. But the event is carrying on. Organisers have taken to X to say it's a peaceful event. As soon as the police turned up, they could see they were doing nothing wrong. And Suella Braverman in the last few minutes has got up and started making her speech at this event, the National Conservatism event. I think it's the third one now. I'm not entirely sure about that, but it certainly... Farage has come out and said that police storming it and trying to shut it down made him even more convinced that his decision to leave the EU was the right one. Also breaking in the last hour, a school in London that was taken to the High Court by one of its pupils who was challenging a ban on Muslim prayers in the playground. The court has ruled in favour of the school and said the school was right to ban Islamic prayers and the Muslim student was wrong to say it was discriminatory. The school is a secular school. It's issued a strong rebuttal today about what happened. This has been rumbling on since last year and has garnered quite a lot of headlines. But today the judge at the High Court said, no, the school was right, the pupil was wrong. And Rishi Sunak's controversial smoking and vape bill is being debated right now in the House of Commons, being looked at for the second time. A bit of a Tory backbench rebellion expected against some of this. Many Tory MPs indicating they'll vote no, but Labour and the Lib Dems have already pledged to support it. So it is likely to go through. The ban is the same as the one that New Zealand tried to put through, which is if you're born on the 1st of January, after 2009, you won't be able to buy any tobacco products once you reach legal age. Rishi Sunak's aim is to create an entire generation of non-smokers before they even start.
How are they saying this is going to work, Gemma? Because I don't understand this, because surely if you have to give ID, presumably everyone will have to give ID, you're just going to get somebody else to buy the cigarettes for you. I really understand how this is supposed to work, because I don't think they can make them it illegal for one age group. Well, I guess at the moment, under 18s, but there's a specific reason for that. I mean, it'd be very, very difficult to actually make it illegal for people born after a certain date to smoke. Surely that's not the suggestion here. It's about buying the cigarettes, isn't it?
Yeah, the prosecution will fall on those selling tobacco products. First of all, it would be a quiet word from the police and in a civil manner, literally a civil manner, civil courts possibly. And if they continue to flout the law and continue to sell products to those under that age, but born after 1st of January 2009, then it will be the retailer that faces criminal prosecution. Because, of course, you can't prosecute someone for what they put in their body. That is still a sovereign free choice. And very often people think, I was discussing this with Sonia Poulton earlier, people think that taking drugs, recreational drugs, is illegal. Actually, putting drugs in your body is not illegal. What is illegal is possession, supply, production, and importing drugs. Those things are illegal. But actually consuming drugs is not, because it's your literally your body, your choice. So the onus will fall on the retailer. And of course, a lot of people today, including senior former cabinet minister, is saying, well, all you'll do is create a huge black market and push the problem underground. It's an unworkable bill. And of course, New Zealand were due to bring it in this July, but the new government who replaced Jacinda Ardern, who wanted to bring exactly the same bill. Anyone born after the 1st of January 2009 in New Zealand would not be able to buy cigarettes. Well, that was overturned. Funny how it's all in lockstep, isn't it, James? But whether or not they will get support today, no doubt about that. But whether or not it's workable if implemented, that's a whole entirely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, and it's woke and it doesn't work, I think, is the message, isn't it? I mean, look, you know, most youngsters go on holiday, or a lot of youngsters do, presumably. They just go and buy a load of cigarettes when they're abroad and bring them back. And like you said, it's going to do is push things underground. I mean, how is this going to be policed? What are the cops going to do? You know, they're going to hang around outside pubs in 10 years' time saying, well, you look under 28 or 29, whatever. Where did you get these cigarettes? I mean, it's just ridiculous, isn't it? I think. And also, you know, that's just on in terms of the workability of the law itself. That putting aside all of the sort of issues on freedom, you know, you shouldn't be restricting people's freedom to put inside their body what they want. I mean, personally, I think there's a lot of things which should be legal, which aren't, cannabis being one of them, and other substances as well. You know, we should be educating people and encouraging them to make wise decisions about their body. I think that's part of the problem why we're in, because people just consume all the crap they're given. You know, government says this is good. Government said this is bad. Just a little rubbish. It really is. I think people, it encourages this, just doing what the government says. So, yeah, I hope this doesn't go through. It will be unworkable. It'll be another absolute farcical law, just like the one we've had in Scotland recently on free speech there. Gemma, I'm going to let you go, because I know your voice sounds a bit croaky at the moment, and you'll be with me in the second hour as well. Some more stories to talk about then. To the rest of you, don't you go anywhere, because after this short break, we're going to be talking about Joe Biden. His weakness, I think, on foreign policy is dangerous, my view is, to the whole world. You know, when President Trump was in office, we heard him talking daily on our TVs, particularly when things happened in the world. You know, you could debate whether the decisions he made were good or bad, but he was there. He was present. We didn't get statements from President Trump. We heard him. He was very, very strong. He always said what he thought, and he laid out a clear pathway. Like I said, you can debate whether those pathways were right or wrong. But Joe Biden, all we seem to get is a statement from Joe Biden. And the reason for that is because he mumbles and bumbles, and he can't put out a clear sentence. We get statements, and they're quite often wishy-washy. They don't really kind of set out a clear pathway. So I'm going to discuss all of this with Basil Valentine in a minute, because I think this is extremely dangerous in the current context we're seeing in the Middle East. I think it lays the foundation for other countries to kind of grab the wheel off Biden, because he's at the moment, I get the impression that America is driving foreign policy from the back seat, which, like I said, leaves open the possibility of other countries grabbing hold of the wheel, and we could see disaster but because of that. So don't go anywhere. We're going to be talking more about that after this short break right here on TNT.
better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's news talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right. As I said before the break, I'm worried at the moment. We've got 9 months until the next president of the United States, whoever that is signed in to office in January. And that seems like a long time at the moment. We've got a vacuum, I think, being created by inaction from the Biden administration. Like I said, wishy-washy statements, but also the fact that we never hear a strong president speaking on world affairs. We just get statements from the White House. And I think this is leaving a dangerous vacuum. But I'm really keen to hear what our political editor, Basil Valentine, has to say about that. Welcome to the show, Basil.
Hello, James. Great to see you. And hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
So, Basil, what do you think about the Biden administration? Like I said, there's two, I think, sort of issues that I see, which is creating this vacuum. One is the statements which come out, which I think are usually quite weak, asking Israel if they can just, if you wouldn't mind, just, interpreting the Iranian attacks as a win. I mean, that's not a very strong statement, but also the fact that Biden, we don't hear from him. We don't actually hear him speak. All we get is these written statements from the White House for obvious reasons. What are your thoughts on this? And do you think this presents a real danger to the world, given what's going on?
Well, this is undoubtedly a very dangerous time. It's the first time Israeli soil has been attacked by a foreign country since 1973. As regards the Biden administration, it's an abysmal administration, there's no doubt about it. And he is an appalling president. He gives very few press conferences. There's no strength or virility left in the man of any description. He's unable to deliver a powerful speech, as you say. He's made some grave mistakes over the Gaza crisis, basically giving Netanyahu a green light to carry out genocide. At the moment, I agree that the statement they put out saying that Netanyahu should take the win, as it was reported, it's better than bomb Tehran, which is what some other people on Capitol Hill have been saying. For all his weakness, his senility, his basic inability to do the job properly, at the moment, they are attempting to prevent any further escalation. Now, they could attempt much harder, because they could simply say to the Israelis, if you bomb Iran back, we're cutting off all the aid, all the military and everything else. So, you could easily put a stop to this. Like the, North Gaza Erez crossing was supposed to have been opened after he rang Netanyahu and said that we've had enough of you trying to starve everybody to death. You better open the crossing. The extent to which that has actually happened and aid has started blowing through it is another matter. But the US president does still have enormous leverage with the Israelis, whether they like it or not. And he hasn't really used that. But to return to the central point, at the moment, in terms of the spectrum of political discourse, the abysmal state of it in Washington, at least he isn't rowing in with the crazies who seem to want to start World War III. Now, Trump's position, of course, is, if I'd been president, none of this would have ever happened, because I'm, so more far-sighted and so superior to you that I would have taken diplomacy down a different road. We would be in a different place. But at the same time, Trump also makes some dangerously hawkish noises about attacking Iran directly. So, you know, he's far from the sort of, you know, fully enlightened peacemaker that some people make him out to be.
Yes, I mean, I take what you're saying there, but I mean, I think with Trump, actually, I mean, you know, look, when he was in office, he actually, given what had happened in the previous administration, all of the drone attacks in Pakistan and all other parts of the world, Trump, you know, you like I said, you might sort of question, well, why did he do it that way? Or why did he do it that way? But the fact that he always, when he speaks with determination. He's very, very clear about what he is saying. And I think, you know, if you want to take the analogy of the car, you can, you know, Trump's in sat in the driver's seat. He's got the steering wheel. And, you know, if you've seen them videos of him walking towards committees and stuff with other leaders around the world, where literally he will elbow them out of the way. You know, everybody knows Trump is in charge. You know, you can question his whether the decisions are correct or not, but everybody knows he's in charge. I don't think we get that with Biden. And I think that that actually leaves a dangerous vacuum.
Also, I would add Trump's sort of Washington outsider folksy approach to foreign relations, which scares the hell out of the deep state, is nevertheless a welcome change from the sort of very rigid pseudo-diplomatic positions taken by State Department officials and the current administration. He doesn't regard Vladimir Putin as an automatic enemy, for example. And when David Cameron went to see him last week at Mar-a-Lago, he was sent away with a flea in his ear. Cameron was trying to ensure that Trump would carry on fueling the entirely unnecessary death machine in Eastern Europe, feeding the youth of Russia and Ukraine into the mincing machine, you know. The Trump spokesman said after their talks that they talked about ending the killing in Ukraine. Trump wants to end the killing. And that is his default position. He is a deal maker. You know, last time round, we actually heard him say he wanted to see a world of peace and prosperity. Who knew? You know, which might sound like, well, don't we all want peace and prosperity? But you'd be surprised. I mean, if you actually boil down the official positions of both the Labour and Conservative parties in Britain at the moment, they actually want war and austerity. They try and couch it in language that makes it seem like war and austerity are the only viable options, that we've got no choice. And of course, that's utter rubbish, dangerous rubbish. So, you know, that Trump's instincts are to make deals, you know, the art of the deal, yeah. That was his book. And he likes to make deals between people, and he would love nothing more than a legacy of peace in Eastern Europe and even more elusive peace in the Middle East. So in general, I think he's, you know, both in terms of his ability to project onto the world stage and his oratory, which is far from perfect, but at least he can actually talk. It's more than can be said for Biden. Generally, it would be a step in the right direction, but we do have to be careful because he is very easily influenced. In the last time he was president, the word was that he did whatever the last person he'd met told him to do. So in other words, advisors would go in and see him and say, now, I really think we ought to withdraw the troops from Syria. You know, we're getting absolutely nowhere there, getting bogged down. There's terrible waste of manpower and money. And he went, yes, yes, we'll withdraw from Syria. And then 10 minutes later, some hawks would walk in the door and say, we've got to bolster our presence in Syria. That Assad is no good. And, you know, he's an enemy of the Israelis. So we really need to double down. And he would go, yeah, you're right. We need to double down in Syria. You know, so he is easily influenced like that. And that's a weakness. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, given this choice, I'd still probably take him over Biden.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the other thing that President Trump is not afraid of is taking a risk as well. He showed that. I mean, his meetings with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and other things that he did, they were risky politically for him, but he went ahead and did it, and he got political capital because of it. The problem I see with Biden is that, you know, we keep on hearing, well, Biden doesn't really want to dictate to Israel the terms of its struggle with Hamas because, you know, it's an election year, and the Zionist Israeli lobby, political lobby in America is very, very powerful. So he doesn't want to upset them. He doesn't want to put out a firm statement on Iran either, because, you know, or even increase sanctions on Israeli oils exports, because, you know, that might send prices up at the pump and that would upset American voters. I mean, it sounds like, you know, he's, like I said, in the backseat of the car and would rather just do nothing unless he sees, you know, the car veering off the road. It's not a great way to conduct foreign policy. I would much rather have, I think, like you said, a President Trump who at times can say some ridiculous things, and there's big question marks over who he surrounds himself with as well as advisors. But I think the way things are at the moment, I see Biden actually as a threat to world peace, and a huge, you know, leaving a huge vacuum, I think, in world affairs, which I think is very, very dangerous. Basil, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'd like to talk about this high court judge being removed from a case in part because of his membership of the Garrick Club. I think this is woke infiltrating the legal system, because surely it should be about his ability and his performance on the job as a judge. Nothing to do with what clubs he's a member of. But I'm really keen to hear your take on this, Basil, right after this short break on TNT.
TNT Radio News. Bring the news.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled planned retaliatory strikes against Iran following a phone conversation with U.S. President Joe Biden. President Joe Biden has called on congressional leaders to expedite the passage of a $95 billion foreign aid package aimed at supporting Israel and Ukraine through the House of Representatives. The FBI has initiated a criminal investigation into the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which resulted in the deaths of six construction workers last month.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa. Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Right now, me and Basil were having a quick conversation in the break, as we always do there. And I think you've got a couple more things you want to say on Biden before we move on, Basil.
Yes, I mean, he's a bit like Gulliver and the Lilliputians, except he's no giant, but he is tied down by 101 different strings. On the one hand, he's got his progressive base, which includes a lot of young Jewish people, as well as Muslims and progressives of all sorts, who are appalled by the genocide in Gaza and are staying at home in large numbers, large enough numbers to swing the key swing states Trump's way. Michigan, Wisconsin, places like that are going to go Trump without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, in fact, at the moment, he's facing a Trump landslide. But at the same time, if he's too critical of Israel, then he loses the support of his donors and the all-powerful Israel lobby. So he is in a bad place. Apparently his wife is the one who has been putting pressure on him to do more to relieve the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. And finally, that's the key thing. You know, the situation there hasn't got any better. 68 people at least have been killed in the last 48 hours in the Middle East, all of them in Gaza. A lot of them shot by snipers attempting to return home to the north. I've seen this on social media this morning, James, I can't verify it, that the Israelis have been using a helicopter drone playing out the sound of a baby crying. And when somebody then emerges from the rubble to investigate the sound of the baby crying, they are shot. I mean, you can't get anything more sinister than that, can you? As I say, I've seen that on social media. I can't verify it. So, you know, just imagine for a moment, 68 people had been killed in Israel over the weekend by the Iran so-called attack. Yeah. Well, we'd be in World War III by now, but they're Palestinians, so they hardly register on the news cycle.
I mean, this is the problem for me. Look, nobody, me included, nobody sensible anyway, has said that Israel doesn't have the right to defend itself. But I think the thing is, you know, it's not defending itself, is it? Killing 30,000 civilians is not defense. You know, starving over a million people is not defense. I'm quite frankly sick.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you. Just to finish off very quickly on this, you know, to be cynical about it, Netanyahu's whole objective with bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killing seven people, was to create a distraction from what's going on in Gaza. And suddenly we've seen the United States, Britain, France, all once again reinforcing their support for Israel just at a time when it was ebbing away diplomatically because of the genocide, you see. So he succeeded in that respect. We're talking about that. We're not talking about thousands being killed.
That's very cynical of you there, Basil. Are you saying that Netanyahu's playing politics on the world stage? I think you might be right. And yes, of course, you are right about we have gone from an ebbing sort of support from world leaders to once again them all being forced to come out and parrot, you know, in lockstep, what the G7 message is. Basil, I don't want to spend the whole show because we've been talking about this quite a bit. Give me your assessment on this High Court judge that's been removed for being a member of the Garrick Club.
I think it's a total farce. I think it's absolutely ludicrous. The idea that something like this would have happened 20 or 30 years ago, people would have joked about it. Sir Jonathan Cohen is the judge in question, and he was due to hear a family court case involving a dispute between a mother and a father over their son's care, with the mother accusing the man of domestic abuse and controlling and coercive behaviour. Fair enough. But for some reason, he has been recused from the case because he belongs to a male-only club, as if that means that he would be prejudiced in favour of the man. I mean, first of all, it's absolutely absurd on its face because, you know, the whole point about judges is that they're appointed because of their tremendous intellectual and moral clarity. So, you know, whether or not he lunches with other men at the Garrick Club or with men and women in a restaurant is absolutely neither here nor there. It's completely absurd and very insulting. And the other point, which people forget, is they're focused on the Garrick Club. I'm slightly surprised to see Sir Jonathan is a member of the Garrick Club, because traditionally the Garrick Club is a very artsy club founded by David Garrick, an actor. And indeed, it was the Actors Club. Judges are more likely to belong to clubs like White's, Pratt's and Boodle's down in St. James, the more aristocratic, even more upper crust clubs. They're all male still, right? I've no doubt there are judges amongst the membership roles of White's, Pratt's, Boodle's and the Athenaeum and the rest, you know. So why aren't they being targeted? It's just absolutely bonkers from start to finish.
It is, isn't it? And I think, you know, you can talk about woke infiltrating the legal system and all this, but I think it actually undermines the whole legal system itself, because it kind of suggests, like you said, you know, well, what hobbies do you do? Which pubs do you go to? Exactly. Which football club do you go to? Is there any violence at that football club? Maybe you shouldn't be. It really does undermine the whole premise of judge, what their job is. You know, his performance should be assessed on what he actually delivers on the job. And I've read stories and I haven't heard anything sort of criticizing, you know, past cases or any other substantial reasons why he should have been taken off this. So, absolutely crazy, Basil.
Very damaging, really. Very stupid and very damaging like you say, and it undermines the whole basis of the judiciary, and it's an insult to Sir Jonathan Cohen as well.
It certainly is. Basil Valentine, TNT's political editor, thank you very much, Basil. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, James.
Right, OK, we're going to take a short break now, and then we're going to be talking about another touchy topic. We're going to be talking about UK immigration. There are stories emerging now that the UK government is in discussion with other countries apart from Rwanda to send immigrants there, some of them former Soviet countries. So has this policy actually got legs, or is it just a big distraction? Is the UK government going down the wrong road? I'll be putting all of these questions to Charlie Downs, who's an independent political consultant. So don't go anywhere. Stay right where you are, right here on TNT.
Sometimes a car comes along that changes everything. With innovations never thought possible and features that make you wonder, how did people survive without this? This is that time, and this is that car. This is the world's first DWB. Equipped with transparent doors to eliminate reasonable suspicion, whatever that means. A 10-2 steering wheel that keeps hands visible at all times. We remove the glove box so there's no confusion about what the driver is reaching for. With a touch of a button, the ultrasonic biometric scanner displays the license and registration of the driver to ensure contactless exchange of information. With no trunk, nothing can be concealed, so therefore, there is nothing to search and seize. To ensure you'll never be mistaken for breaking the speed limit, we've installed limited edition airless tires. And we removed the engine because, honestly, why risk it? DWB, the first vehicle of its kind, where the safety feature is the car itself.
I have a feeling these are the suspects in question. The two occupants look like the people involved in the armed robbery. I'm approaching the vehicle. Request backup. The driver matches the description because of a wide-set nose.
She was reading at a second grade level in kindergarten.
Pod forced swimming before she was 7.
Finally convinced mom to get her ears pierced in the 3rd grade.
Came in 2nd at her 5th grade spelling bee.
Drill team in the 7th.
And with one stroke of the keyboard.
One click of the mouse.
It's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone.
Report a cyber tip today.
This is the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right. Now, according to the legacy media, the UK government is now in discussions with countries such as Armenia, the Ivory Coast, Costa Rica, Botswana, all in the context of the Rwanda policy for sending migrants that come here illegally to those countries to be processed. But it's not very successful so far. Rwanda has been, seems like it's been discussed for years now, and it's still, the policy still isn't in place. And there's big question marks about whether it'll work, even if it is put in place. So to discuss all of this, I'm delighted to be joined by Charlie Downs, who's a political, independent political consultant. Welcome to the Freeman Report, Charlie.
Hi, James. Great to be with you. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. So, Charlie, what do you make? Before we kind of go down the rabbit hole and actually discuss current policy on immigration, give me your assessment so I know where you stand on the situation with immigration overall in the UK.
Now, I believe migration is the single most pressing issue of our time in the UK. I say this as somebody who is, I'm 22 years old, I'm very young, and I look at this country and what it can offer me, what this country is in the modern day, and it just seems to be a place where nobody can afford to buy a house, the healthcare service doesn't work, it's really hard to get places in schools, the roads are falling apart, the public transport system hardly works, and the whole thing's basically a mess. We're a people that's completely scattered. You know, we have no culture, we have no, you know, we're not properly taught our history, and I think all of this well, not all of this, a lot of this can be put down to the fact that since the end of the Second World War, we've had mass migration to this country. It's the most pressing issue, and the people in power seem to have no interest whatsoever in doing anything about it. If anything, they seem to be wanting to ramp it up and intensify it with every passing year. Now, of course, the story we're talking about today focuses specifically on illegal immigration, which is, of course, a very important issue. I mean, we had 40,000 plus illegal immigrants arrive in our country last year. But it's not the most pressing issue. If anything, I think it's used to distract from the main issue, which is legal migration. Because for all the talks of stopping the small boats, I think that the conversation should really be about stopping the planes and stopping the ferries. Because that's really where the issues are arising from. Now, this story that we're talking about today, where the UK has been talking to several countries, among that is Armenia, to deport illegal immigrants to, or have them put into a holding facility in these countries. It's like, okay, great. You know, that worked really well with the Rwanda plan, didn't it? You know, that's been a roaring success, as we all know. Funnily enough, Armenia have actually said, they've actually come out and said, well, no, we haven't actually had any sort of specific technical conversations about this. Like, it's been mentioned. But it seems to me that as usual, the ruling class of this country are just floundering around, and they are saying things they don't mean. They're committing to things that they have no intention of following through on. And it's just a continuation of the sort of the general feeling of decline in this country.
I'd agree with some of that, Charlie. I'm not sure I'd go as far to say that immigration is the sole kind of thing responsible for all the problems we have now, because actually in the past, the Windrush generation actually, I think economically, benefited the UK a lot. You know, it brought in lots of workers to bolster our NHS and do a lot of the jobs which at the time UK people didn't want to do. I guess my problem with immigration, I mean, and by the way, you know, I was in the Brexit party, but immigration was never an issue for me. I didn't follow UKIP on immigration or any of that. But it is an issue now, I think, because, you know, we've just seen after Brexit, when most people, I think, voted for Brexit, at least partially wanted immigration controlled. And we've just seen the biggest influx into the UK ever. I think 672,000 in the year to June last year after Brexit. And then, of course, we've got this problem, which is, I think, a national security problem with undocumented people coming across the channel. I mean, would you go, do you think that immigration overall is bad? Or do you think that actually we should be getting people into the country, but people with the right skills, and also, I guess the most important thing for me is the right number of people so that they can actually integrate.
Mm. Well, there's an interconnected set of problems here, aren't there? Because there's you're right to say that migration has been, the reason given for migration in the past has been filling worker shortages. And that's true. There have been worker shortages. But why have there been worker shortages? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, we don't train enough of our own workers. Two, we offer people benefits who don't work, who could be working, but who choose not to. If you look at El Salvador, El Salvador is emerging as a shining beacon of a country on what, you know, what good governance actually looks like. They have very recently come out and said, we're going to begin a new migration policy, but it's basically, instead of being low skilled, you know, very sort of basic jobs level migration, it's like elite level migration. It's very, very selective. And it's only, I mean, we're told that our migration system brings in doctors and scientists and engineers and lawyers and all the rest of it. It brings a few of those, but the vast majority are low skilled workers. A piece of research came out just this week showing that in the last 2 years, the average salary of migrants has dropped by £10,000 to around £22,000. So that gives you an idea of the caliber of worker we're bringing in. If you wanted to just bring in doctors, engineers, you know, and so on, high skilled elite level workers, well, then that would be less of a problem, I think. I think if anything, that would be, you know, it would be useful to our economy, if you want. But with that being said, I mean, I do still think I have a principle level problem with migration, because I think that it has done enormous damage to our country. As much as it has been useful in the short term, in a kind of economic utilitarian sense, in the long term, in the cultural sense, it has been damaging, because we've never seen a demographic shift in this country like the one we've experienced over the last 30 years or so, you know, when my mass migration truly kicked into high gear after Tony Blair. And I think that you go around the towns and cities of this country and they are unrecognizable. I'm actually coming to you from Cornwall right now. I'm on holiday, so you have to excuse my slightly relaxed get on. But this is an area of the country that has some of the lowest levels of migrant population, less than 500,000. And you can tell I'm not being funny. This is nothing to do with being prejudiced against people. It's just a fact that when you walk around the towns and villages of Cornwall, there is a very different texture to them. Then I'm actually from the southeast. I'm from Kent. And when you walk around certain towns in Kent, they are unrecognizable because the streets are lined with tacky vape shops, Turkish barbers, which in many cases are fronts for money laundering, and just, you know, run down streets. Whereas you walk around Cornwall and it still feels like this is Britain. It still feels like you're in England when you're in Cornwall, but it doesn't when you're in certain places in the southeast.
Yeah, I mean, what would you do to solve it then? Because, you know, we have got millions of people who are not working at the moment, who are claiming benefits. But, you know, governments have been talking for years about, you know, well, we've got to be tough. We've got to get them working and training UK people. How would you go about it then? How would you go about solving this problem so we don't need immigration?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think the problem with the system that we have, the type of politics that we have in the West in general, is that the time horizon on which our leaders think is so short. The time preference is incredibly high because we live in a system where every 5 years, politicians are thinking about getting re-elected. So they can't think. You know, you look at somewhere like China or Russia, for example. Now, you can say what you want about their system, but they're thinking on a time span of decades, 25-year plans, 50-year plans, 100-year plans. That's unthinkable in our society. So because we have that kind of mindset, we cannot countenance the idea of a short-term sacrifice in an economic sense, where we do have a period where maybe there are labor shortages. Maybe we can't get our Deliveroo delivered like that. But we train our own workers and we put them to work. And those people who are on benefits, who aren't working, who could be, are put to work as they should be. Then I think in the long term, we'll be far better off.
It's an interesting point you raise there, actually, because what you often find is, when people come to the end of their career, in whatever career they're in, and they no longer feel sort of controlled and beholden to their employer, they actually then start quite often to speak out and saying what they really think. Do you think that we should maybe limit the terms that politicians can hold in office? Maybe two terms, for example. MPs can only stand for that because actually in their last term, they're more likely to actually do that long-term thinking and maybe make some sensible decisions instead of just thinking about getting re-elected.
It's a really interesting idea. Now, I actually have a fairly old-fashioned view of this, I suppose. And when I say old-fashioned, I'm talking about, you know, it was the majority opinion about 500 years ago, which is I think that leaders are born, right? Leaders are not made. And I think a leader is somebody who is, you know, who is decisive and who does have a certain quality about them that not everybody does. It's something, you know, they are somebody that people are drawn to. And I think that, you know, those leaders who are wise, who are prudent, who are sensible, who are centered in themselves, they deserve to be leading countries. And those people deserve to lead countries, they could, you know, for decades. Because I think that the kind of continuity that something like a monarchy brings is very good for a country. Whereas the constant churning, you know, every 5 years, every 10 years, it's a new leader. I don't think that's that healthy for a country because we're pulled this way and that. Whereas when you have the stability of a lifetime leader, I think in general, it's better for the health of the country, for the cohesiveness of the country. And that's why I think monarchy is quite a good system of government. But that's a very different issue anyway.
Really? Well, that is quite extraordinary. So you would actually, in a world where you could decide our governance, you would actually put the monarchy back in charge then?
I just think that system of government is more honest than democracy, because the thing you learn about power and about societies when you study politics, as I have, is all societies, regardless of whether they call themselves democracies or monarchies or communist or fascist or whatever else, they all have the same shape. There's always an organized minority at the top of that society ruling over the disorganized mass of people. And that's always going to be the way, because organization is power and power is organization. They are one and the same thing. And so if you always have a small group of people at the top of the society basically running it, the elite class, well, the kind of the name of the system doesn't matter if it's always going to have that same shape. I think that a system that's honest about that, and that's honest that that is how all societies in all times of places have always worked, then that's better. And especially if you have a single person who is the head of that country, you know, in Russia, for example, there's nobody higher than Putin. Everybody knows that Putin is the guy in charge. There's nobody behind the scenes pulling his strings. Whereas in our country, I mean, do we really believe Rishi Sunak is the guy running this country? Like, do we really believe he has the final executive authority on all issues? I don't. I don't know who's in charge of this country. And that's part of the problem with our system, is there is an obfuscation of who is actually in control. It is obscured through layers and layers of bureaucracy. And you don't have that when you have one person in charge.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting conversation. I'm not sure I agree with you, because I think you're talking about different things there, Charlie. But this is an interesting conversation, nevertheless. I think transparency, I agree with you 100%. I mean, that's supposed, what we're supposed to get in democracy is clearly not what we get by a long stretch. There's lots of obfuscation about why decisions are really being taken, about who's taking them and who's influencing who. We really could do with some transparency. But I guess my question to you, based upon your argument, would you be happy with Prince Charles running the country?
Now, this is the other thing, is it's not, it's like, just like the shape and structure itself is not enough, because the people occupying it have to be high caliber and have to be competent and have to be aristocratic.
Forgive me, Charlie. Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there. But what you're saying is, you know, we need people to just be put there and to be in charge for a long time. You can, I guess, have both things, can you? You can't say, well, not Charlie, and then, I don't know, you put someone else there and then they disappoint and they're not the strong leader, and then we've got to change them. So we're back to that whole thing about how you choose a leader. So I'm not quite sure your argument, and Prince Charles is a good example, I think, because I was keen to hear whether you actually think he would be a good leader. Personally, I think he'd be terrible.
Let me tell you, do you think he'd be worse than Rishi Sunak and the Conservative Party?
If he was a dictator in terms of he was king and you couldn't remove him, then I think, yes, absolutely. I think he would go much further than the government. I mean, at least the government, and I know, look, I think democracy in the West is a bit of an illusion, but there is still a hint of democracy there. The establishment didn't want Brexit. They've done everything they can to not deliver Brexit, even to this day. But we voted for it, and it has had some kind of impact. It's not the impact we wanted, but it kind of shows that when we all kind of sit up and just stop listening to the politicians and do what we want, we can still vote for things.
That's interesting you bring up Brexit there, because I think that that is a perfect example of what the Conservative Party does best and has always done best, which is containing and diffusing dissident energy. Because Brexit was a genuine populist revolt against the regime that governs. It was a genuine expression of dissent by the people. It's rare. It's not often you see that, especially in Britain. But that's what it was. And what was done to it? Well, it was taken in by people like Boris Johnson, and it was turned into, rather than being an expression of essentially nationalism and basic, you know, a crying out for sovereignty, it was turned into, oh no, it's an economic thing. We're going to be global Britain. We're going to be, you know, UK PLC and all this sort of thing. That's not what the people who voted Brexit wanted. The people who voted Brexit wanted England. They wanted Britain. They wanted the settled homeland that has been taken away from us. But what they got instead was this kind of corporate expression of Brexit. And I mean, where has it led us? I mean, 1.2 million migrants last year. That's one outcome. I mean, I genuinely, if we were still in the EU, I actually don't think that would have happened. I actually, and I say this as somebody who is very, very much opposed to what the EU is in its current incarnation, I genuinely think we'd be better off. I mean, I wasn't old enough to vote in 2016 for Brexit. I would have voted for Brexit at the time because I agree with the sentiments that it represented. But today, I mean, it's been a disaster.
Yeah. I agree with you. The only kind of saving grace, I think, with Brexit is that if we do wake the country up and stop listening to the politicians and start voting for parties which aren't red and blue, then I think we have got the opportunity to take our control back of our country. Whether that happens or not is a totally other thing. But really, really interesting conversation with you there, Charlie. Charlie Downs, independent political consultant, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me on the Freeman Report. Right, okay, we're going to take a short break now, and when we come back for the second hour of the show, I'm going to be joined by TNT's very own Johnny Vedmore. So stay put right where you are right now on TNT.